appearance, because some people think that's inner appearance. Modesty is modesty, that is when you're all alone. It can be modesty of your eyes, of your ears, like Dr. Karimi explained that so beautifully in the entire session. Thank you so much, Dr. Karimi. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. Stay tuned for more interesting programs to the station. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Saudi ties with the United States. Part 3.
With the long classified pages detailing alleged ties of the Saudi Arabian government to the 9/11 hijackers have now been released by Congress.
They confirm what many have suspected all along, that the 9/11 hijackers...
15 years after the 9/11 attacks, the U.S. government finally released a long-classified parts of an official report on an inquiry into its intelligence community activities before and after the attacks. Those parts were 28 out of hundreds of pages that provided details about the incident and results of the inquiry. According to these 28 pages, a number of officials of the Saudi embassy in Washington and its affiliated institutes had close ties with people involved in hijacking commercial planes and crashing them into the World Trade Center in New York City. The officials had helped the hijackers travel, reside, study, and even receive driving education in the U.S. 15 out of 19 people who carried out the 9/11 attacks were Saudi citizens. But for everyone, especially the families of the victims, it was very strange that what made different American administrations, from Democrat to Republican, act so cautiously in this regard. Years on, those families, as well as journalists and observers, are still confused about such stance. It seems strange for everyone that where this bond began and how it grew that has granted such immunity to Saudi Arabia, whose relationship still continues with the U.S. despite the fact that thousands of Americans were killed in the 9/11 attacks. Circle of extremist Wahhabi youths were formed during these years who could not withstand all these changes. In their view, the social situation in Saudi Arabia was very different from what it was during the beginning years of the creation of the country. And this way, a group that was cohesive and serious to counter these changes was formed under the leadership of a young man called Juhayman al-Utaybi. Several hundreds of people, along with Juhayman, occupied the sacred mosque on the first day of the lunar month of Muharram in 1400 AH to show that they would not tolerate the changes. They wanted to save Saudi Arabia from the wrong path it was taking, and therefore they took on a promising expression on their faces.
Juhayman and his followers put up a strong resistance to the extent that Saudi Arabia appealed to French special forces for help. The occupation of the sacred mosque came to an end after 14 days and following bloody clashes between the two sides. More than 100,000 Soviet armed forces invaded Afghanistan at midnight of December 27, 1979, to support the government formed by People's Democratic Party of Afghanistan. Two years into its formation, the Afghan government was engaged in a civil war following an uprising over its plans to change the social and religious structures of the country. Then U.S. President Jimmy Carter quickly issued a decree ordering a covert operation by the CIA to send arms to Afghan fighters from across the world. The Central Intelligence Agency, CIA, quickly appointed a team to provide all kinds of support to Afghan Mujahideen, and Pakistan was chosen as the nearest venue to organize, equip, and train them. Then Pakistani President Muhammad Zia-ul-Haq entered the operation in the hope of receiving military and financial assistance, as well as finding a strategic role in the region. Therefore, a mounting propaganda campaign against the Soviets' occupation of Afghanistan was launched across the world, especially in Islamic countries, to accelerate the process to recruit youths and dispatch them to Afghanistan. More than 35,000 people from 43 countries in the Middle East, North and East Asia, Central Asia, Far East and North Africa pledged allegiance to Afghan Mujahideen, and at least 20,000 of them went to Afghanistan to fight there. Among the young people who eagerly came to Afghanistan and Pakistan was a person named Osama bin Laden. He was from a prominent family that was highly influential due to its construction companies and close ties with the royal family in Saudi Arabia. Osama bin Laden met with Abdullah Azam, who was in charge of organizing migrant youths, and Osama was already acquainted with him in Saudi Arabia. After forming Bayt al-Ansar in 1984, that was one of the most important jihadi groups in Afghanistan, Osama, by 1986, established six more bases for the youth coming there from other countries to organize and direct them. Strikes by the Afghan groups against the invading forces were highly effective. The war, leaving heavy casualties, finally forced Soviet troops to leave Afghanistan. The last batch of them left the country on February 15, 1989. Meanwhile, a group that took a different path was Arab Afghans, those young people who had come to Afghanistan from across the world to help people there in the face of the occupation of their country. Since the majority of them were Arabs, they were called Arab Afghans. The rest decided to continue the path of fighting in different parts of the world. Their leader, Abdullah Azam, intended to transfer his forces to Palestine to continue jihad there after the occupation of Afghanistan ended. But Azam, along with his two sons, was killed in a suspicious bomb attack in Pakistan's city of Peshawar in 1989. It was in the early days of Osama's return to Saudi Arabia when everyone was shocked by an incident. Then Iraqi ruler Saddam Hussein invaded the country's small and rich neighbor Kuwait, advancing near the town of Al-Khafij on the border with Saudi Arabia. Osama, who had ties with the Saudi royal family, proposed that thousands of his forces be used for battles against Saddam to drive out the Ba'ath army from Kuwait.
Osama believed that non-Muslim armies should not enter Islamic countries, especially Saudi Arabia, at a time when thousands of fresh fighters already defeating the invading Soviet army are able to fight Saddam's army. Saudi princes opposed Osama's proposal, probably because they were not hopeful that it would be practical, or they did not want him to turn into a national hero in this battle. A coalition led by the U.S. was formed to drive out Saddam from Kuwait. Such a coalition had not previously been formed in any war. The opposition of Saudi officials to Osama bin Laden's plan angered him, and it was the beginning of a direct fight against the interests of the U.S. and its Arab allies, including Saudi Arabia. That was because Osama considered Arab leaders as being completely controlled by the U.S., and he decided to target the U.S. with his attacks. The beginning of the 1990s marked a new era for Osama and his followers as they felt that they had been betrayed by everyone and that they should find a new way. Attacking U.S. interests in different parts of the world was top of the agenda of his organization called Al-Qaeda. The manpower required to do the job had been trained with the help of the U.S. and Saudi Arabia years before and was present in all parts of the world following the Afghanistan war and was now ready to carry out the attacks. During these years, Osama lived in Sudan for a while, where he did business and carried out economic and development activities. Under pressure by Saudi Arabia, Osama returned to Afghanistan in 1996 with his former friends. At this time, the Taliban were in control of large parts of Afghanistan and were practically the indisputable ruler of the country. Finally, the September 11 arrived, and the storm that the U.S. had launched in Afghanistan years before returned home. According to the official account given by the George W. Bush administration, 19 people, 15 of them Saudi nationals, boarded U.S. Airlines passenger planes. In a few minutes, they hijacked the planes and attacked a number of key U.S. buildings, including the World Trade Center. Now, the talk of the town was Al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden and the Taliban who had sheltered him in Afghanistan. The
The shock caused by the 9/11 attacks and the extensive media coverage of them was so high that prevented everyone, especially the Americans, from thinking about this question, that how was it possible for people in another part of the world, in a devastated country like Afghanistan, to plan such an operation and train individuals for it? In the days that followed the 9/11 attacks, several private jets were assigned with withdrawing a group of Saudi families from the U.S. They included 24 people from the Bin Laden family who were withdrawn without being investigated and left the U.S. to avoid being attacked by angry Americans. The U.S. asked the Taliban to hand over Osama. They rejected the request and the U.S. quickly prepared to invade Afghanistan. A war quickly began and Afghanistan was occupied again, this time by the U.S. New bombs were dropped on the ruins left from two decades of war. After the 9/11 attacks, a commission headed by Bob Graham was formed to launch an inquiry into U.S. intelligence community activities. The commission investigated the activities of the CIA and the FBI from February 2002 until December that year. It released an 832-page report on the inquiry, of which 28 pages were classified.
Former U.S. Senator Bob Graham has been trying to get the 28 pages released since the day they were classified back in 2003, when he played a major role in the first government investigation into 9/11.
Those 28 pages were about a foreign state's involvement in the 9/11 attacks and its financial and logistical help to the hijackers. That pits the families of the victims of the attacks, as well as many journalists and politicians, against the Bush administration. They voiced their objection to the classification of those 28 pages in the following years, but to no avail, and the pages remained in secrecy.
Proudly, deliberately using his full name, Barack Hussein Obama, he became the 44th president of the United States.
Finally, the tenure of President George W. Bush ended, and the new president entered the White House. Barack Obama, despite facing pressure to declassify the pages, also refused to do so, partly because of Saudi threats to sell $750 billion in U.S. assets.
Today, Congress gave families of 9/11 victims the right to sue Saudi Arabia on the theory.
Less than 5 months before the end of his presidency, the Obama administration published a full report on the congressional inquiry into the 9/11 attacks, although many parts of it were still covered in black. According to these 28 pages, two of the hijackers named Khalid al-Mizhar and Nawaf al-Hazmi had close ties with Osama Basnan and Omar al-Bayoumi. Basnan and al-Bayoumi had ties with the Saudi embassy and Ambassador Bandar bin Sultan, the key man in U.S.-Saudi relations, and they received salaries from Saudi company Dar al-Arkan without having a job there.
two hijackers since their arrival in the U.S. until several weeks before the attacks were provided with services by the group linked with the Saudi embassy. Another issue that the 28-page part of the report had raised was the transfer of money by Saudi charity organizations based in the U.S. and Europe to suspects of terrorist activities. The inquiry by the 9/11 Commission emphasized that Saudi Arabia had long funded the Al-Qaeda group through its wealthy citizens and charity organizations that enjoyed high financial support. Despite that, the inquiry concluded that there is no evidence that the Saudi government as an institution or senior Saudi individuals funded Al-Qaeda. Maybe the best answer to this question has been given by Bandar bin Sultan, the former Saudi ambassador to the U.S.
We don't have taxes in the kingdom. People don't pay taxes. However, we have a religious tax that's dictated by our religion. And it is supposed to go to the poor. If you cannot find anybody needy, you go to the next neighborhood, or the next village, or the next city, or the next country. Well, in Saudi Arabia, God blessed us with a lot of wealth. We take care of almost all our people. So we send it to Afghanistan, to Bosnia, to Senegal, to anywhere in the world, to Africa, Asia, my point, the Arab world, but as charities.
But the reality was that those amounts of money were mostly used to build schools and mosques that spread the Wahhabi thinking in the world and led to the formation of groups such as Al-Qaeda and their new form, Daesh. The most controversial news in this regard came out while the U.S. was in the process of passing the Justice Against Sponsors of Terrorism Act, known as JASTA. The bill passed the Senate and was aimed at allowing families of the 9/11 victims to sue the Saudi government and enabling them to ask for tens of billions of dollars in damage if their case went ahead. Controversy arose after the New York Times revealed that quote-unquote senior White House officials had contacted members of Congress demanding that they reject JASTA. The officials had cited threats by Saudi Arabia to sell $750 billion in assets in case that law is implemented.
On Wednesday, Congress overwhelmingly voted to override President Barack Obama's veto of the Justice Against Sponsors of Terrorism Act, also known as JASTA, which would allow Americans to potentially sue Saudi Arabia for the 9/11 attacks.
U.S. District Judge George Daniels in Manhattan, who rejected the lawsuit filed by the families of the 9/11 victims, said Saudi Arabia had sovereign immunity from damage claims by them. The status means that sovereign governments are immune from lawsuits in U.S. courts. Despite all the indications, Judge Daniels issued a weird ruling on May the 1st of 2018.
A federal judge is ordering Iran to pay billions of dollars to the families of the victims of the attacks of 9/11.
Iran should pay $10.5 billion in damage to the families of the 9/11 victims and several insurers over what the U.S. federal judge called its role in the attacks. That ruling was not taken seriously even in the U.S. Maybe Saudi officials' direct link with the 9/11 attacks cannot be exactly found, and perhaps it's basically wrong to find such a link in a 28-page report and its covered lines. The reality of this story is the whole history of Saudi Arabia, where people in schools have been taught hatred for more than 100 years now.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked among
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant factor.
Imamat yek asl zinda dar tarikh Islam.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by the late Ayatollah Agha Mojtaba Tehrani. Stay tuned.
در یه روایتی از پیغمبر اکرم داره صلی الله ما بدا لکم من
حبا. In a very beautiful hadith by Prophet Muhammad we read, ask Allah for everything you want. This sentence of Prophet Muhammad means that we can ask Allah everything we like, from the minor ones to the major ones. In continuation of the hadith, Prophet Muhammad states, even if it is your shoelace. We can find how much Allah is concerned about our life, that we even can ask Him for our shoelace, based on this hadith. This shows the grace of Allah upon His creatures.
چرا علت؟ فَإِنَّهُ إِنْ لَمْ يُيَسِّرُهُ.
But why we must ask Allah everything we want? The reason is that if Allah does not provide for us, then nobody will be able to do so. This beautiful hadith of Prophet Muhammad changes our viewpoints in life. When we read it, we understand that we must only remember Allah in our lives. In better words, all the big and small affairs of the universe are in the hands of Allah. Whether you are rich or poor, low or high in status, you must only ask Allah what you want. He is the only omnipotent entity that can answer our needs. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by the late Ayatollah Agha Mojtaba Tehrani. To find out more about this program, log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en/Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The Biden administration asked a U.S. judge for a 60-day extension before it formally weighed in on whether Mohammed bin Salman, the Saudi crown prince, ought to be granted sovereign immunity in a case involving the murder of Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi. The request comes after President Biden's return from a trip to Saudi Arabia and West Asia, in which he claims to have raised Khashoggi's murder with the Saudi crown prince. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Stephanie Kirchgassner. The piece is titled, White House Seeks to Delay Decision on Prince Mohammed Immunity Over Khashoggi Murder. Biden administration asked the U.S. judge for a 60-day extension before it formally weighed in on whether Mohammed bin Salman, the Saudi crown prince, ought to be granted sovereign immunity in a case involving the murder of Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi. The Department of Justice said in a filing before a U.S. district court that it had initiated a decision-making process about whether it would file a statement of interest in the case, but that it would not be able to comply with the court's requested deadline of 1st of August. The United States is diligently considering the court's inquiry, but the process for doing so requires consultation among multiple entities within the executive branch of the U.S. government with respect to complex issues of international and domestic law, the filing said. The judge in the case granted the U.S. government its request and gave it until 3rd of October to submit a statement of interest. The request comes just days after U.S. President Joe Biden returned from a controversial trip to Saudi Arabia, in which he met with Prince Mohammed bin Salman and claimed to have raised Jamal Khashoggi's murder in a private conversation with the crown prince. Jamal Khashoggi, a Saudi native who resided in Virginia, and wrote critically about the Saudi crown prince's crackdown on expression and dissent within the Saudi kingdom, was murdered by Saudi agents in the Saudi consulate building in Istanbul in October of 2018. An unclassified intelligence report into the murder, released by the Biden administration shortly after President Biden took office, concluded that Prince Mohammed bin Salman, known as MBS, ordered the murder. Biden promised on the presidential election campaign trail to treat Saudi Arabia as a pariah state in the wake of the murder and refused to personally acknowledge the crown prince's role as a de facto ruler of Saudi Arabia until his recent visit. President Biden said after his meeting with Prince Mohammed that he had confronted the Crown Prince about Jamal Khashoggi's murder and suggested he told the prince that he held him personally responsible for Khashoggi's murder. But Adel Al Jubeir, the Saudi foreign minister, said he didn't hear Biden say that to Prince Mohammed. In response to that claim, Joe Biden said Adel Al Jubeir's account was dishonest. Al Jubeir also stated in a recent interview that Saudi Arabia cared deeply about human rights and maintained the official Saudi position that the Jamal Khashoggi killing, which investigators have shown was premeditated, was a rogue operation that occurred without the knowledge of Mohammed bin Salman. Attempts to hold Saudi Arabia accountable for the murder have so far failed. A trial held against unnamed defendants in Saudi Arabia was widely condemned as a sham, and Turkey recently ended its own trial in the murder. The only remaining avenue for Prince Mohammed bin Salman to face some legal consequences is in the United States, where Jamal Khashoggi's fiancée, Hatice Cengiz, has filed a civil lawsuit against the Saudi Crown Prince for ordering the killing. John Bates, a district court judge in the US, said in early July that he was inviting the US government to weigh in on legal questions about whether the trial should go forward and whether the United States has an interest in the case. He also said he would hold a hearing on 31st of August after motions to dismiss the civil case by Prince Mohammed bin Salman and others. The motions to dismiss the civil case rest on claims by Prince Mohammed's lawyers that the Washington, D.C. court lacks jurisdiction over the Saudi Crown Prince. In his response to the government's filing, Judge John Bates said he welcomed the parties in the case until 20th of July to state their views on whether the 31st of August hearing should be delayed. For the Biden administration, it is a whole different level to go out of the way to give Mohammed bin Salman immunity in a court of law over the most documented assassination that he ever did. To give legal immunity would give Mohammed bin Salman a license to kill, said Abdullah Alouz, the research director of Dawn, a non-profit organization that promotes democracy in the Middle East that was founded by Jamal Khashoggi and a co-plaintiff on the case against the Saudi Crown Prince.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back.
Allah, ya Allah.
back to the program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. We are going to talk about the family-related issues according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtaza Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching Makassas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Sheikh Jawid, we are talking about family-related issues according to Ayatollah Khamenei's fatwas. There are social norms in the society, and one is supposed to or is expected to observe those norms. For example, you have family members, you have relatives, and sometimes they expect you, in fact, to do a norm, a social thing or activity that whether you like it or not, whether it's, totally or purely Islamic or not, you are expected to do so. For example, for one thing, wedding. Wedding yeah. parties entail a lot of things, a lot of activities, one of which being dancing, for example, and it happens in lots of these parties, all right? And mm-hmm. not everybody is totally, purely religious or strictly religious, all right?
Yes.
And is there any objection to attending, let's say, wedding parties, for whatever reason? Maybe it's a courtesy, all right, to the bride and groom or to your relatives, for example. So is it permissible to attend those parties if there is a possibility of even dancing in it?
Okay, bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. According to His Eminence, Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, there is no objection to attending wedding parties where dancing may be there and dancing may take place. Of course, there's a condition. It's necessary that it's not considered. One's going to the such parties is not considered as an act or as a manifestation of approval.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you go to such a place and you're going to such wedding parties, is considered an act of confirming or approving of the activities that are going there.
Mm-hmm.
It's not permissible.
Mm-hmm. You know, sanction it.
It shouldn't be deemed as such on on the part of the partaker, the person who takes part.
Yes.
It should not be deemed as such. And of course, it shouldn't also lead to any kind of evil or any kind of evil consequences or vile consequences.
Mm-hmm.
For example, if you go to a wedding party and there is, you know, there is music being played or song being, you know, played, or maybe there are people dancing there, you can sit at a corner,
mm-hmm.
and you can just ignore. You can just sit there without having to deliberately and willfully listen to the music. I know you will hear the song and the music, but hearing is different from listening. So as long as you do not listen
or focus
intentionally, you're not to blame. The same is true with, for example, seeing some people or watching some people dancing. You as a partaker must not be considered as an act of approval or confirmation of the activities that are being done by the people there.
Sheikh Tawi, there is a question quite related, but because of the shortage of time, let's take a short break and then we'll be back and I ask that question.
Sure.
Stay with us.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are talking about family-related issues, according to Ayatollah Khamenei. And before the break, I asked you, Sheikh Javid, a question regarding attending wedding parties. And, you know, quite related to that issue, there is the, activity which is or activities which are performed and carried out in such parties. Is it permissible to dance in one's own offspring's wedding party?
Well, it is not permissible to dance in such places, know, dancing, because you will be dancing there not for yourself, but you are dancing for other people, with women and men, you know, watching you. And Grand Ayatollah Khamenei says that if it is of the haram type of dance, you know, it is not permissible. Haram type of dance means dance which is accompanied by music, because the people cannot dance without there being a music played. Okay.
Yes.
So it is the dance is automatically rendered into haram type. It becomes haram once haram music is played, and it causes the individual to dance, you know. But okay, if it's a kind of a traditional dance, just as we see somewhere in some parts of the Islamic Republic of Iran, let's say, and there's no music accompanied, So it's kind of folk dance. I'm not saying that Grand Ayatollah Khamenei does allow folk dance, but you know, there are some types of dance which are not haram, you know. If
it's part of the customs, you mean?
Yeah, it's kind of traditional. Of course, again, I cannot use the word traditional because it may be very much misunderstood.
Yes.
And it's very much likely to be misunderstood. So, generally speaking, if it is a kind of haram dance accompanied by haram things, of course, Grand Ayatollah Khamenei does not allow it.
I see. Is that the dancing of the wife for her husband halal or haram, or the other way around?
That's a good question. You know, Grand Ayatollah Khamenei says that if it is done without the commission of any haram act, there's no harm in it. There's no problem. So it is permissible for a man to dance for his wife and a woman to dance for her husband, generally speaking. And of course, this answer should not be misunderstood. You know, haram music should not be played and haram stuff must not be involved. Yes. Okay. If a woman wishes to dance for her husband, she can do so.
And people's customs is that, or in some countries, that, for example, not only does the wife actually dance for her husband or the husband for his wife, sometimes it is so much so that they dance with their parents. For example, a sister with her dad, for example, father, and or a boy, son with his mom. Is that okay too?
It's not, again, I should say it's not permissible. The only dance which is permissible, of course, in a gathering of, let's say, two people,
right,
is the dance of a man for his wife and a woman for her husband.
I see. Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Chavi, for your nice contribution to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio, and you shed some light on some of these, questions related to family issues, according to Ayatollah Khamenei. And we ask you for your prayer for the crew here, Sheikh Javed and me and the producer. Thank you very much for listening to us. We leave you in Allah's care and pray for us, please. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم من جاء لا إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير لا إله إلا هو وحيد قدير محيي مميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.